Everybody, I don't know if we've got a quorum yet, but we're going to start. And welcome all the folks from the university. I'm sure President Brunick wants to probably jump right into it with Mr. is going to be up there. But we also have other chancellors from the all the different campuses too with us today, and I'm assuming that you're going to be coming up later on. But go ahead right now, the two of you, and get ready to go. Welcome, President Brunick.
Thank you, Representative Rukavina, Chair Rukavina, members of the committee. It's great to be with you once again, although I can think of earlier times when I've been here where I thought the prospects were a little better than the ones we face at the moment. But I nonetheless welcome the opportunity to come and talk about the university and talk about how we're at least setting our course for the future. I'd like to introduce three members of the Board of Regents who are with us today. Regent Cohen, Linda Cohen is with us on this side of the room. Regent Stephen Hunter in the back, and Regent John Frobenius just walking in behind me. I want to thank them for being here. We have chancellors with us today, Chancellor Casey, Chancellor Martin from Duluth, Casey from Crookston, Lim Cole from Rochester, and Vice Chancellor Cheryl Confant is with us from the University of Minnesota Morris. Chancellor Johnson could not be with us today. So I want to thank them for joining us here today, as well as some other university officials who will probably have better answers than I do to some of your questions. Well, anyway, I'd like to just quickly go over a few things, and I know you had some specific questions about how the university has managed and is managing budgetary reductions and some thoughts about the future. I'd like to spend a little time on the agenda that you have. You told me you're going to run this. I got good help today. Anyway, here's the agenda we'd like to spend some time on, a little on the progress of the University of Minnesota in the last several years. Fitz will spend some time, that is Richard Fitzenreiter, our Chief Financial Officer, Vice President for Finance, will talk about the state appropriation, the outcome of the 2004-05 budget reductions, and an update on the most recent reductions that have come as a result of the rescission. We'll talk a little bit about the biennial budget, and mostly I hope we'll have ample time to take your questions. I get a chance every once in a while to talk about the University of Minnesota, and I believe very strongly in the first line of this first slide, and that is the university is stronger, I think, today than it has at least been in any of my 41 years of service to the university community. I think we deliver an exceptional education. We have a very active program, highly recognized nationally and internationally recognized program of research and discovery that drives innovation and growth within Minnesota's economy. And I think this is a public land-grant university that is deeply embedded in the interests of Minnesota and deeply committed to be of service to the communities of Minnesota. And I think in all of these three parts of our mission, education, innovation and discovery, responsiveness to Minnesota communities, I think we've made tremendous progress in the past 10 years. And I think it's really important, despite the economic challenges we have at the moment, to try to maintain this momentum. It's a critical part, I think, of Minnesota's competitiveness in the world economy. I won't spend a lot of time on the next slide because I've been here before and many of you have heard these comments, but I think today we deliver a better education than any time that I can recall on the University of Minnesota campuses. We have record applications on the Twin Cities campus alone. We expect 32,000 applications for somewhat over 5,000 freshman admissions this coming fall. The retention, graduation, student satisfaction rates are all moving in very, very positive directions. I'll say a couple of words about those. We granted 14,000 degrees. statewide last year. You can see some of the highlights that we think capture some of the undergraduate innovations that have been part of the University of Minnesota campuses in the past 10 years. We're deeply proud of these innovations. We think they've had a lot to do with doubling our graduation rates. That is time, or reducing the time to graduation and actually increasing those graduation rates in the last several years. And a great deal to do with the profile of the undergraduate degrees of the University of Minnesota. I thought it was interesting to note from some recent statistics that nearly half of the degrees in science, technology, engineering, and medicine come through the University of Minnesota. About 75% of the advanced degrees in these fields are University of Minnesota degrees in Minnesota's economy. If you take a look at healthcare, about 75 to 80% of all the advanced healthcare professions are prepared at the University of Minnesota in Duluth and on the Twin Cities campus. So I think it's a very strong educational profile, one that you can be proud of and really serves Minnesota and serves it well. A second aspect of the university's mission, obviously, is research and discovery. We are your research university, and we're deeply proud of the record of accomplishment that we can present to you today. This past year, faculty and staff at the University of Minnesota campuses received about $675 million in competitive research grants and contracts, nearly $700 million. That's up more than 8% year to year. And over the past 3 years, as this slide has indicated, we've increased these expenditures by 19%, and that is a record of accomplishment and a rate of growth that is second nationally among public research universities across the United States. And I want to tell you, this is a very deeply competitive business that we are in. And for the University of Minnesota to make that kind of growth, or that achieve that kind of growth over a three-year period, I think is truly remarkable, and it has a lot to say about the quality of the people we attract and keep at the University of Minnesota.
Excuse me, Mr. Chairman. Representative Mahoney.
Doctor, I'm sorry. You were going faster than my lack of hearing aids could work. Did you say you had your research was second and the number two in terms of dollars for all research universities or all public research universities?
Chair Rukavina, Representative Mahoney, what I meant to convey is that in this past, we're ranked about ninth among public research universities across the country today. And that's in terms of the top 30, 40 research universities that compete in this area. But we also benchmark ourselves annually against this cohort group, and we also run a three-year running average. And that second-ranked position, that 19% growth rate, was second among our peer group, that is, public research universities in the entire country. So it's this rate of growth that I was really trying to reflect. But the overall standing is very, very strong as well, and it's something that I think gives a great deal of strength to Minnesota's economy and quality of life. Just to put this in perspective, if, according to the Department of Commerce, for every $1 million of funding you bring into the state of Minnesota, nearly all of this money comes in, or most of it comes in from outside of Minnesota, you create roughly 36 to 40 jobs in the private economy. I'm not talking about the jobs that are created on our campuses and on our research stations, but in the private economy. So this economic activity that we're talking about is probably responsible for up to 25,000 jobs in Minnesota's private economy. It is a big part of the economic activity of Minnesota. And it's also a big part of what drives the economic engine of Minnesota. I'm often reminded of the story that the late Bob Sparbo once told me about how a university researcher by the name of Ben Pomeroy, used to see Ben at the legislative hearings, and before he died, he went out early in the evolution of Sparbo Farms during his Thanksgiving holiday, and Bob Sparbo would frequently tell this story that he literally saved his business by solving a very serious infectious disease problem that he had among the animals in his on his farm. And that's just one of many things. You know, bone marrow transplant for childhood leukemia was started at the University of Minnesota. We're now in the top three institutions worldwide in that particular area. Those discoveries have practically cured childhood leukemia. Survival rates were in the 20% range when John Kersey and his colleagues came up with this discovery and this application, and now those survival rates are well into the mid-80s or above. These discoveries are really a very, very important part of our economy and quality of life. I don't have to tell you how taconite and the discovery of E.W. Davis after 28 years of research at the University of Minnesota did for the northern part of our state in the Iron Range, and what it has done, I would add, to the economy of Minnesota and the welfare of Minnesota. So that's a big part of what we do. It's a big part of what I think keeps Minnesota competitive, and it's a big part of what we need to keep our eye on if we're going to maintain the vitality of not only the university but of our state. I should also point out one thing in addition with respect to the university's research mission, and that is by being successful in this area, we've been also able to attract very, very significant private investment, long-term private investment without strings attached. The largest gift from the Masonic Charities last year to conduct leading research in cancer prevention and treatment. The most recent gift from the Schultz Family Foundation, close to $40 million over a five-year period, to find a cure for type 1 diabetes. These investments were made at your University of Minnesota because people believe that the work going on at the University of Minnesota was among the very best work that could be found anywhere in the world. In fact, the Schultz family actually did a national and international study of other research being conducted in combating, curing, and combating type 1 diabetes before they made this transformative gift to the University of Minnesota. The other thing I want to say is that we are a public research and land-grant university, and we take our public responsibilities very, very seriously. You know a great deal about what we do. You know a great deal about the Extension Service, the research center network that we have throughout Minnesota. But I'd like to think that we're on the cutting edge in this area as well through the work that we do in Minnesota communities throughout the state. I've given you some highlights. Many of these are quite familiar to you. ACRC is something called the Academic and Corporate Relations Center. That is a center at the university where businesses, small, mid-size, and large, can come to the university, come through a common portal, and get help and to solve some of their most serious problems. It's also a way that we build partnerships so that businesses in Minnesota can leverage the technical expertise, the equipment, scientific equipment at the University of Minnesota at very, very reasonable cost. AHEC is Area Health Education Agency. That's a network of centers across the state of Minnesota, largely sponsored by federal funding, that provides continuing education to the health workforce of Minnesota and is another big part of the university's land-grant responsibilities and, I think, accomplishments. You all know about the extension reorganization. I'm pleased to talk about that. I should tell you that one of the things we planned to do when we reorganized extension into regional centers was to increase the technical capacity to respond quickly to the needs of Minnesota communities. The University of Minnesota Extension site is the most visited site in the entire national extension network across the United States. This next map gives you a sense of where we're located. When people talk about the University of Minnesota, they tend to think about one large campus.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and President Brunick. It seems like maybe we're leaving kind of the research component of your presentation, and I did have a question before we do that. Can you give just a quick recap of where you feel Minnesota is relative to commercializing the technology that comes out of the university, maybe what you see the university's role and how we're doing and what's coming in the future in that regard?
Chair Rubina, Representative Downey, I think this is a pretty good story as well at the University of Minnesota. It's not that we can't make a better story, and we're committed to doing so. But in the past several years, we've literally revolutionized the technology transfer capacity of the university. So it's much more adaptive, much more effective at protecting intellectual property, you know, filing the necessary patents that are important to protecting your work, but also working much more effectively in partnership with the private sector and commercializing promising ideas. One of the things I intended to mention is a discovery that occurred at the University of Minnesota Duluth, the development of a drug called Tamiyosin. This is a drug that could be used to treat trauma incidents where people are in accidents or on the battlefield and are, have serious problems of blood loss. And this discovery was, of all things, developed by studying the hibernating habits of many of the animals that seem to occupy that region of our state. And this is now left...
Talking about rangers.
Yeah, I was talking about... No, I'll let you have that line. That's right. Yeah. But anyway, that now has been protected. The clinical trials have been done. It's now going through a commercialization stage. And so I can just tell you that in recent independent assessments of university patents and intellectual property, we've been ranked in the top 10, usually between about 4 and 6, in terms of royalty income off such intellectual property. We're right around 5th or 6th in the country, but I must tell you that 80% to 90% of that comes from one particular breakthrough, and that's what tends to happen with the commercialization of intellectual property. You have the Honeycrisp apple, and you have a lot of other things, and then every once in a while you may get a big breakthrough. Like taconite was a huge breakthrough for the medical device industry in Minnesota. That was a time when we didn't get royalty income off that kind of work as we do now or can do now. So I think we're in a really strong position. In fact, there are many places in the country that are trying to model their work after the work that we've done recently here at the University of Minnesota. And I have to give Vice President Mulcahy, our Vice President for Research, and his colleagues a good deal of credit for the progress we've made in this area. It's hard work, and it takes a lot of time to incubate an idea and then to get it, you know, get it to a point where it can be commercialized and used for the benefit of people in our state. Some of our best breakthroughs have been in agriculture and animal health, and for example, vaccine dealing with avian flu influenza developed at the University of Minnesota. So there are many examples like that I think are pretty spectacular and have worldwide implications.
Representative Park, if you...
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. It's a question I often pose to you, Mr. President, and others, and I just need an update, I guess. I'm wondering if you could provide the committee with a listing of the various corporations and, you know, companies that are providing the funding for the, you know, providing some of the gifts and the funding for the research that we're doing here, and also those who are benefiting. I live my ongoing interest, and I believe there's some legislation that has last year, maybe Representative Mahoney had it in his bill, I think, that we are interested in finding out when there is a public taxpayer dollar contribution to the university to a product that is to benefit the public. What is the benefit? Does it reduce the cost, for example, of a pharmaceutical drug that we've helped create, or I don't know what Vitamix is, but Tamiyosin or anything. What do we help make them cheaper and more affordable to the public because the university has invested in them? So that kind of cost benefit to the public investment is something I continue to be interested in. So if you could give me an update or give us an update, I don't need it right now, but it would be helpful to know that. And it's both that and then the list of who the corporations are that are benefiting or investing.
Yes. Chair Rukavina, Representative Clark, I'd be happy to give you a response, and if you don't find it satisfactory, I hope you'll let me know. We'll make sure you get the information you need.
Thank you.
All of the grants and contracts that we get from public and private sources are all public. We don't do research that compromises our ability to disseminate it, and if we do, it takes a special dispensation from me personally after a very, very careful review, and it is rarely, rarely done. I can recall in the last 10 years only two examples. And we do everything we possibly can to get ideas out into the marketplace and to make them accessible. Most of the patents of the university, most of the intellectual property, I must tell you, does not net the university any benefit, and we're seriously considering ways now to share research and discovery more widely and at little or no cost to the public. Because there's this feeling that if you have a discovery and an idea, that it will be the next best idea to get rich at the University of Minnesota. And only about 1 or 2% of the discoveries that are ever protected have commercial value. And so in many cases you protect them too much and you don't allow them to improve the safety of the water supply in Africa or to do many of the other things that our research has uncovered. So anyway, I'd be happy to do that. I think it's a very important question, and I think it's a very important public obligation that we share with all of you.
Just one second.
Yes.
Representative Mahoney, did you have a question to that?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I know the time it's a long presentation. I did want to compliment the university on its technology and commercialization transfer. It was something I battled with and then worked with and am very grateful for. The strides that you've made, and I will compliment Dr. Mulcahy publicly and privately whenever, although he's a little worried about my sense of humor, but that's his problem.
We'll work on that.
My real question is, has the university worked very well with the office over at DEED of Technology and Commercialization? And you may not have that, and I would suspect that Dr. Mulcahy would be a better one to ask that of, but maybe at a later time you can give that to the committee.
Yeah. Chair Rukavina, Representative Mahoney, I know that we have very active discussions underway with them, and I know that whatever partnerships existed have been greatly strengthened recently, but I can't give you chapter and verse, but I'd certainly be happy to ask Vice President Mulcahy to send you a letter that could be made available to the entire community.
Thank you. Representative Hodson, I'm trying to let him get through the rest of this.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chair. My question for the testifiers is, what type of money is taken in on the royalties, and how is it dispersed back to your university?
Chair Rukavina, Representative Hawes, the annual royalty payments, I'm just operating from memory, and perhaps Vice President Fitzenreiter can help me here, but I think roughly range between $55 and $60 million, with nearly, I'd say, 85% of that coming from a single source and a license that expires in 2013. So the point, a couple of points to make in that regard, and that is that I don't think you commercialize intellectual property to solve a budget problem at the University of Minnesota. I think you do this work to advance knowledge, advance discovery, advance application, and you constantly have to ask the question that I think Representative Clark was asking: are we doing a good enough job of getting research and discovery out into the public for the benefit of the public good? Now, how is that money spent? It's mostly invested back in research. It's not used for overhead, and the policies that we have do give some part of that back to the university. About half of it goes back to the support the research infrastructure of the university. About a quarter of it goes back to the person's home department to fund research in the laboratories and other activities that led to those discoveries, and then a quarter of it would go back to the inventor. That's basically how it operates.
Mm-hmm. Mr. President, none of it goes back to the students at all?
Representative Rukvina, yes, it does, directly and indirectly, because those students are employed in the labs. The University of Minnesota probably has a higher student employment rate than any other campus in the Big Ten. And so a lot of it does go back to students directly and indirectly into their support.
I've got some constituents that are crying for help, so I'll make sure you get them
some
employment there later on.
Well, I think I can present you with some pretty good facts and figures if you're curious about how students benefit from their employment at the University of Minnesota. It's a good story.
They may get one of the apples from Apple Crisp that's getting the royalties, I think.
Go ahead.
Well, let me just show this slide before I ask Fitz to take you through some of the financial figures that we wanted to share with you. I thought it'd be interesting for you to see what happens to state support and student tuition and fees, and what those sources of support, the roughly $1.2 billion a year, fund at the University of Minnesota. It supports 70% of the total spending on instruction, more than three-quarters of the total spending on student services, about three-quarters of the total spending on faculty compensation. You take the largest college on the Twin Cities campus, it's about 93% of the total budget, close to 80% of the total budget of the Institute of Technology, and about 75% of the total budget of the College of Food, Agriculture, and Natural Resource Sciences. If you take our coordinate campuses, those numbers would be even higher, pretty close to 85 to 90%, depending upon the campus you selected. So the point I'd make here is that state support, along with tuition, is a vital part of funding many of the core functions, or I'd say most of the core functions of the University of Minnesota. Without it, we clearly would be in very, very deep trouble. The other point I would make is that all of the faculty funded here are also the faculty that are pulling on the oar and doing the research and writing the applications that we talked about. And the students directly benefit from that by working in their laboratories and working on their projects. I'd like Richard Pitzenreiter to take us through some slides that give you a little of the contextual background to the university's budget and the impact of these reductions on the university's budget and how we've handled that over the last few years.
Mr. Pitzenreiter, maybe just for the committee's information, you know, in the first slide you've got your appropriation from last biennium of $1.2 billion, but just so we understand the importance and enormity of the university itself, what's the total budget? What's the total income of it? University.
Mr. Chairman, members, if you include all funds, including sponsored research funds, we're approximately a $3 billion annual enterprise. And that includes money from all sources, whether it's business and industry grants, federal grants, as you can see, tuition revenue, state appropriations, housing, food, parking, intercollegiate athletics, system-wide $3 billion operation.
There you go, members. Okay, go ahead.
Mr. Chairman, members, what I want to take you through, and some of you I think are new here, but I know a lot of you were here in the early part of this decade when the state of Minnesota faced a substantial budget problem, and in one sense, this chart's here to show you that it looks like it's back again. Just want to remind you that back in April of 2002, the University of Minnesota was cut $23.6 million because of a pending budget problem. In January of 2003, we were unallotted another $25 million in preparation for a budget reduction that then amounted to, in the 2003 legislative session, in which we were cut an additional $195.6 million. So there was two early budget cuts and then a large budget cut that occurred that impacted the 2004 and 2005 biennial appropriations. And then thanks to the hard work of the legislature, the support of the governor, the university's budget began to grow again. But as you can see, now we're facing unallotment and budget cuts again. And I'll come back and talk about how we dealt with those budget cuts in a minute. But I just want to remind the committee here that last May, we, the University of Minnesota, and Minsky took a cut as well, we were cut up to $12.3 million. And then, of course, the governor just recently unallotted us $20 million. So you can see that it kind of comes in two stages here of unallotment. And then, of course, for the 2010 and 2011 operating biennial budget, we're, of course, anticipating the governor's recommendation next week on what our appropriation here for the biennium will be reduced. In a sense, very strong sense, it's happening to state government again, and you can see the cycle that we're in. With respect to the large cut, the $195.6 million reduction in our biennial budget base appropriation back in the 2003 legislative session, the university doesn't just face, and will not in the next cut, just face a cut from the state. We have additional financial obligations that the university has to deal with that adds to and compounds the budget challenge that we face. And back in 2003, for the 2004 and 5 biennial budget period, we not only had the $195 million cut, but we were grappling with another $121.5 million a budget challenge. And that additional budget challenge comes from are we or aren't we going to give our employees a compensation increase? What's the cost of health care increasing? What are the academic investments we need to make? What are the new building operations? What are the utility bills? What are the debt obligation, lease payments, contractual obligations for software and technology licensing? Those all add to the budget challenge that the university faces. And we grappled with this challenge in 2004-05 by obviously laying out a plan that also called for students to contribute, and they helped with, as everyone I think knows, back-to-back double-digit tuition increases. They helped solve about 46% of the problem back in 2004-05. And we also had our faculty and staff and students assume about 15% of that problem. And they dealt with that. We dealt with that part of the $317 million challenge with a wage freeze, one out of those 2 years, and a substantial change in the structure of our health care benefits by requiring our employees to take on an increasing share of that cost and, for example, almost doubling the co-pays that we required our employees to contribute towards health care. That solved about 15% of the problem. We had some additional, what we call institutional revenues, that we were able to raise that helped solve about 8%. And then the balance of it, roughly a third of it, was resolved with budget cuts, including things like where we ended up reducing about 515 positions through layoffs, attrition, elimination of unfilled positions. There were around 515 of those that occurred. The university libraries was forced to reduce acquisitions, cut service hours, cancel journals. CLA eliminated small classes back then, reduced some course sections. College of Ag, Food, and Environmental Sciences reduced research assistantships back then. Funding for the Rapid Agricultural Response Program was reduced. We suspended over 60 faculty searches back then. We did do things to put much of our human resource activity online for our employees, which allowed us to save some money. We even eliminated two positions in the president's office back then. Those are just examples. Now, during this period, we also have, in addition to actual budget cuts, we faced lost opportunities. We weren't able to retain faculty. We lost two key positions over in the Academic Health Center during this time. So budget cuts don't just result in reductions, it also means we lose opportunities that come along the way to retain faculty or hire new faculty. In the jumping ahead quickly to the May of 2008, last year's budget cut, it was $12.3 million, and we addressed that budget cut just About half of that budget cut came from the UMail partnership reduction, and the remaining part came from roughly 25% from central reserves and about 25%, 24% by delaying investments that we would have preferred to have made, new academic investments in the current fiscal year, 2009, but because we had less money, we were forced to cut those back. I want to just stop for a minute and make sure the committee understands what central reserves is, because that may not be a term familiar to this committee. By Board of Regents policy, the university administration is to maintain a 4% budget reserve based on our total state appropriation, which includes both our O&M appropriation and our state special appropriation. By board policy, that balance should be, in the current fiscal year, roughly $26 million. That central reserve balance today sits substantially below that board policy level, and it sits at roughly $13.8 million, principally because of two reasons. The chief one is that in the recent economic crisis facing the country, the university did have a $9.9 million loss due to a Washington Mutual bond, and that loss, that realized loss, has been covered through central reserve. So it's an example of why we maintain that reserve at as robust a level, because it's there to meet emergencies. Last year, the cut came late in the session, and we tapped into that last year, about $3 million, just to help solve part of that reduction.
Representative Reiner.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just want to clarify, when you were going through the numbers, they don't match up with the handout that we have. So just to clarify, the investment delays are about half the solution, not your reserves.
You got the colors wrong or the percentages wrong for your statement, Mr. Pleasant?
The colors are wrong. About half of it was.
You had black and white, the cheaper Xerox machines. You will
get that straightened out for you. Sorry. Well, you know, Mr. Chairman, when they move from a PC to an Apple, they seem to change colors.
Could you quickly just reiterate what the correct percentages are then?
The UMail partnership, if I recall right, is the pink, not the yellow.
I have a black and white copy.
It would be the half of the problem was solved with the UMail partnership.
All right. Thank you.
And roughly a quarter on central reserves and a quarter on investment delays.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Mr. Chairman, members, then I just want to turn quickly to the most recent unallotment of $20 million. As you recall, the governor unallotted both Minsky and Liu $20 million. Our revised appropriation for the current year then is biennial appropriation is roughly $1.358 billion. Now, the university has taken steps to address that $20 million unallotment. We have distributed that unallotment to every academic and administrative unit at the University of Minnesota. The president and his academic folks and myself have advised him that we feel the entire university should take a share of this cut. We have not, we have chosen not to use that remaining. Someone might say, why didn't you use the $13.8 million remaining in central reserves? And we've made a decision that it's wiser at this point, at this time in the fiscal year, to distribute that $20 million. I think everybody's aware, and we're aware, that the what is now, I think, called the March forecast could turn substantially worse again, and we want to make sure. Now, I'm saying that hoping you don't turn around and cut us again, but we're certainly nervous about what could happen, and we felt at this point it would be more important for the academic and administrative units to deal with this cut, because if a cut comes later, either in March or even a May surprise, like it did last year, we may turn to that last amount in central reserves to help cover it. But what units will do for the $20 million is they will look at program investment delays. They'll begin to trim their supply and equipment budgets. Some folks will look at whether they're going to advance some of the planned expenditures for some modest capital improvements that were going to be made in classrooms or labs. And they'll trim general operating budgets and look at any really money that they may have that they can delay to a future date and save some funds. Mr. Chairman, just to move on then, what does the future hold? And I put this pyramid up simply to remind the committee, as I said earlier, that no matter what happens on the budget cut from the governor, ultimately what comes out of the legislature, the university faces about $90 million of new costs. And some of this cost we have choices about, but on average we face an incremental $90 million of additional costs. And of course, one of the single biggest ones, roughly half of that cost, reflects whether or not we're going to provide a compensation increase and at what level. We need to make and continue to make, to keep the momentum of the university going, a certain level of investments in new programs. Those are choices, admittedly they're choices, but some level of investment has to continue. It's not as if we can just stop dead in our tracks. We will face facility operating costs. We will face new debt, new leases, things that are in the pipeline that are just going to have to be paid for. We will face more infrastructure investments. We do have to pay our software licensing. We just implemented a new financial system. We will have new licensing costs for that. We do have a founder's free tuition program, an important program started by the president. Those costs will go up as tuition goes up because we're making sure that all those Pell-eligible students are protected from any tuition increase. And we will have safety and contractual obligations. We do have a need to, for example, we're hiring more police on the Twin Cities campus to deal with safety issues in the periphery of the campus, and we have to address those costs. So again, it's just a case of making sure the committee knows that your cut has one impact, but we do have other costs that we have to wrestle with to pay for, either not do or decide to delay. With that in mind, this chart's just designed to emphasize again that our approach to solving the problem will begin, and of course we've been doing some contingent planning and thinking about this. As we get the governor's budget cut, we'll begin in even more earnest here. We'll take a look at what the state budget reduction is from the governor. We will and do have a sense of what our additional costs are that we'll face next year and in the next biennium. That provides us with the scope of the budget challenge, and we'll get to work and hopefully be working closely with you on how to devise the strategy to balance the university's budget, which we must do, and we will bring a balanced budget to the board in June when the legislative session is over. So with that, Mr. Chairman, that's just a quick overview of how we've dealt with our budget problems in the past and really how things, how we anticipate approaching them as we go forward.
Question of the, perhaps at this time we could bring up, you know, none of us know what the budget, the governor's budget proposal is going to be, Mr. President or Mr. Fitzenritter, but assuming it's proportional to, you know, your percent of the budget, and it's 9 or 10% for higher education. What are we looking at for to solve that? I mean, in real ideas, not just an abstract idea.
Chair Rucavina, members of the committee, could I just make, before I address that question, could I make just a couple of final closing remarks?
You certainly can.
All right.
We don't believe in censorship on this.
I appreciate your indulgence. I'd like to just add a couple of comments because I think this next slide will at least address some of your concerns or at least touch on some of your concerns. Before I do that, Patricia Simmons, chair of our Board of Regents, has joined us after I introduced the regents, so I want to acknowledge her presence at this time. She's on my right. And let me just make a couple of comments here. I think all of us are obviously deeply worried about the trends in this economy and what the impact will be on the state of Minnesota and on the institutions that we're committed to preserve. And I think there's no issue in higher education that has captured more public attention than the issue of access and affordability. If you look at the reauthorization of the Higher Education Act, it took several years to reauthorize the federal Higher Education Act. It provided additional funding for low-income students, additional loan capacity. But most of the debate centered around this issue. How do we keep the doors of opportunity open for young people and working adults in our states and in our society? This has been a big issue at the University of Minnesota, and I must tell you, I've made it a personal cause in the last six and a half, close to 7 years. And I think one of the things we will have to do is we'll have to work together as we did the last time, that is last year, when we, with the help of this committee, put together a very innovative idea to restrain the growth of tuition costs for middle-income families. We're going to have to work together on some of these solutions, and I'll come back and make just a quick comment or two about that before I end. Pitts mentioned something called the Founders Free Tuition Scholarship. This is one of the few programs you'll find anywhere in the country for Pell-eligible students, students whose average family incomes are about $27,000 to $28,000 a year. 36% of the students eligible under this program are students of color, and most of them are, a good share of them at least, are first-generation college students. They will see no increase in tuition. That's about 12% of the student body across the University of Minnesota campuses. Half of the students will get very substantial scholarship support. The scholarship support that we give our students has more than doubled in the last 5 years thanks to a very successful private fundraising campaign where we matched significant private gifts. That average now is approaching about $6,500 a year. The university now provides $75 million through private and internal support to help drive down the cost of tuition and the cost of education. There have also been very significant reforms in the tuition systems. Part of the way that you can really drive down the cost of education is to make sure that students stay on time to graduate. And the average time to graduation at the University's Twin Cities campus was running a little bit in excess of 5 years. We've been able to substantially reduce that through these tuition reforms that allow students to take credits above 13 for free, 13 and above, I should say, for free. And that can save the average student an average of more than $20,000. So I think there are lots of things we need to do. We obviously will have to cut budgets, but we also need to be very creative in how we think about financing the future of education for students. And we need to be much more creative and agile in leveraging not just public support, but also private support, because I think there are many people in our society that want to give back and make sure that young people and working adults have the same opportunities they enjoyed through the GI Bill, the National Defense Education Act, and lower costs than is clearly the case today. Just a couple of really quick things on this next slide. Some people who are well known to you make some comments about the importance of investing in education. Every one of us recognizes that we have a very, very serious economic challenge, and no one really knows, including all the leading economists, how long it will take us to get our economy in this state and in this country back on track. But I can tell you the fastest way to get it on track for the long term is to stay the course in investing in education at all levels. And I know we can't keep all of our budgets constant. We're going to have to do our fair share, and we're going to have to take some real hard knocks in this process. But I hope we won't tear apart the core infrastructure of Minnesota, an infrastructure that's really made us, in many cases, the envy of the country in these next several months. One final comment I would like to make is tease off a comment that was once made by H.L. Mencken. He once said, for every problem, there's a solution, simple, neat, and wrong. So I'm going to ask you, on behalf of the university community, as we go through these next few weeks, to give us the maximum degree of flexibility in how to manage these very, very difficult challenges. We will do everything possible to keep this burden as low as possible on students. We'll do everything we can to protect the jobs of our employees. I feel that should be one of our top priorities going into this very turbulent period. I don't really like the thought of laying off large numbers of employees into this kind of an economic downturn and this kind of an economic market. Plus, we need these valuable employees to deliver the service every day that is provided at the University of Minnesota. So I'm making a plea to you, as we go through some really tough times together, and we've been there before. I don't know that they've been quite this bad, at least in my modern memory. But I'm hoping that you'll give us the kind of flexibility that we need to manage these changes in the most creative fashion. There isn't a single place that I know on Earth that's more transparent than the University of Minnesota. You may think it's obscure, and there are days when I get up and I think it's obscure. But I can tell you, everything is done in the light of day. Everything is publicly vetted. Everything is voted on. We will be in very close contact with you as we go forward and try to solve these problems together. I'm fully cognizant that we're going to have to take some hits here, and we're going to have to try to manage them well. And I'll make one final comment, and that is that you can count on me to speak out responsibly on these issues in the days ahead. I think why don't we take your questions and comments at this time? There's much more that we could say about the University of Minnesota, but I think we might be better to spend our time by getting into some interaction with you.
Well, Mr. President, why don't we first bring up the chancellors from the other campuses to tell us if they have any concerns, and maybe they can come forward. And because, you know, I mean, Representative Murphy and Representative Reinert, I'm sure, would like to see Chancellor Martin, who came all the way from Duluth, say a few words, and Representative Norton, would like to see Vice Chancellor. Is it... Chancellor Lemker's here too, so why don't you come on down and maybe a little indication of what would happen on your campuses that sometimes I feel don't get as much attention as they should. If we're talking another $200 million or plus in cuts. Come on, all of you, come on down. Don't be afraid. Nobody bites on this committee but me, and it's not that hard anymore.
Mr. Chair, I thought it was $350 million in cuts.
I don't know what it's going to be. Representative Reinert, did you have a question before for the Chancellor? Or
I did have a question for the President, can wait.
Okay. Why don't you just come on down, pull some seats up there for them if we can. Maybe a few of these comfortable seats by Representative. Jeff, do you want to come? Jeff, you want to come and grab some of these other seats here? Yeah, those. We don't want, hey, they're university employees. They don't American to sit in folding chairs, for God's sake. They're not used to that. Okay. Chancellor Martin, would you like to start?
Chair Rukavina, members of the committee, thank you for the opportunity to speak to you today. I would first like to echo President Brunick's comment about as we face these enormous fiscal challenges, maintaining a high level or maximum level of flexibility in solving those problems. I think that's critical. I speak for a campus I'm extremely proud of, and I think many of those of you here who are familiar with the University of Minnesota Duluth understand my pride. I would point out to you that in the past 12 years, the enrollment's gone up 35%. We've increased the number of faculty from 25 to 30% and staff from 10 to 15%. We were 7,500 in 1995, and about 10 years ago we were 8,000, and today we're 11,300. Perhaps more important is the change in the vision of our campus and in the recognized quality and in the issues that we have been pursuing as a great responsibility for our university. I would call your attention to the fact that we have added the doctorate in education. We have had a significant number of American Indians from tribal colleges graduate from that program. We've added a PhD in integrated biological sciences, which addresses to a large extent water resource and environmental issues. Our American Indian programs are considered some of the strongest in the nation. I've had the pleasure of traveling with two of our prominent faculty to the Evergreen College, State College in Washington, and to Portland State
to view the facilities. The biggest difference was they had the facilities and we had the programs. And I think that that speaks makes a great statement about the quality of programs we have. We currently have a language nest in Ojibwa in the Chester Park School and have a memorandum of agreement with the Duluth Public Schools for Head Start programs to take advantage of those language nests for Ojibwa students. We see this as a primary target for our campus and a huge responsibility. We have graduated more American Indians with Masters of Social Work. I won't say the most in the country because I don't have a definitive standpoint of numbers, but I know we're among the top two or three. Also, with our EDD programs and our PhD, large numbers of students that might have gone elsewhere are staying in the state of Minnesota. We're particularly proud of our new program in civil engineering. The civil engineering program, the building is going up now faster than I've ever seen a building go up because it's poured concrete slabs that they're putting in. But it's going to be a beautiful building, and we anticipated about 25 students enrolling in the first year program, and we have 45. Having mentioned engineering, I can't resist making this comment. As you may know, and if you don't know, you will now, the University of Minnesota Duluth football team won the national championship for Division II. 18 of the students on that football team are engineering majors. And I think that that is, makes a great statement about the quality of student athlete that we recruit. And I would pick the University of Minnesota Duluth in terms of our football team and our 18 engineers on that team, one of whom graduated from the same high school I did, so I know him quite well. I would pit them against any Division I program in the country, except perhaps Duke or Stanford, in terms of the grade points and the quality of students in engineering, in the sciences, and in business on that team. I mention that for a couple of reasons, not just to give myself the opening to brag about a national championship. That's two of them we have this year, by the way. But also...
But did I miss... I must not have heard you right. Did you say there's a kid on the team playing football that you went to school, high school with?
No, I said...
I heard it wrong. Chancellor Martin, I'm sorry.
Chancellor Rukavina, members of the committee, graduated from the same high school.
Okay.
We didn't graduate together. I do have some eligibility left, though, in women's ice hockey, but I don't think they need me. At any rate, how would we survive the cuts? I think that's the question I was asked. We managed in 2003 and 2004. We managed with some grave concerns on my part about course access, providing the courses that students need to graduate in a more timely manner. We managed without filling faculty lines. We managed without filling staff lines. But mostly what we managed because we took advantage of all the vacant lines we had. We did some mortgaging of our future. And we survived. We didn't prosper, nor did it provide us with the flexibility to be better and have higher quality than what we had at that time. The magnitude of the cuts and the magnitude of the reductions that are being discussed now will create probably the most significant damage possible to an institution that has grown from a state institution to a regional with some areas of national recognition. If we are to encounter the size budget reductions that have been suggested, that'll mean the reduction of programs, that'll mean the reduction of faculty. I'm doing everything I can as we begin to plan to avoid layoffs. I hope we don't get there. But I think it's fair to say that for a few years, we'll be behind the eight ball in terms of can we continue to grow, can we continue to grow with the momentum, with the quality, with the access that we have over the past 10 or 12 years? No, we won't be able to. It's going to cause a plateau, and I think you're all aware of what happens when momentum decreases. We don't want our American Indian programs to go on hold. We don't want our doctoral programs on hold. We don't want the quality of our undergraduate programs on hold. We want to keep going forward to grow, to strengthen, to make contributions to the long-term quality of the state of Minnesota. I would make one other observation, and that's the observation about the research being done at the Colerain Laboratories. Over the past 4 years, we've grown from 25 full-time employees to 45 with federally funded research and through PUP funds and through a lot of other sources. We don't want that to slow down. The research that's being done there is critically important to northern Minnesota, to the city of Duluth, and I would say actually to all of Minnesota. And so I can't tell you specifically what would happen, but I can say that it would certainly slow us down. It would, the momentum, the quality, the access would all be damaged. I'm an optimist, so I won't say forever, or I won't say over the long term, but certainly that momentum to regain that quality, to regain all of the things that we've worked very hard to achieve, would be very difficult to do. And the long-term impact, I think, would greatly damage the contribution that we can make for the state of Minnesota. Thank you.
Representative Murphy, can we pull questions so everyone gets a chance and we'll ask them? Because I'm afraid
we have a question, Mr. Chair.
You have a comment. Go ahead.
Mr. Chair, I'd like to expand on what Chancellor Martin said about the pride that she has with the growth of UMD and the university in Duluth in northeastern Minnesota. It's more important. It's much more than what she said. It's the pride of the community, and it's the pride of the change in the economy and the cooperation of northeastern Minnesota. And a large part of that is because of the leadership that Chancellor Martin has shown and delivered. But on campus, there is a different spirit than was there 15 years ago. A spirit of the students, a way of life of the students. It's not just go to class, go home kind of thing. It's a living community that reaches out to the whole community of northeastern Minnesota. And that wasn't there 15 years ago. And I think the thing that epitomizes that more than anything else was this summer's FinFest, the International Finnish Festival that takes place somewhere in the world.
The second one in Duluth, too.
And it was the second one in Duluth, but there were so many more participants this year. From all over northeastern Minnesota. They came down from the range. They went up.
We had a toll gate.
They went up to the range, and they expanded out into Wisconsin and North and South Dakota, and it didn't end when the festival closed at UMD, because family relations were extended into the next 3 weeks past that. And the best thing that's happening is that this weekend I'm going to possibly host a young Murphy that's been accepted at UMD, the first Murphy that is considering going to UMD for 4 years, and that is very important in our family.
Well, thank you, Representative Murphy. Why don't we have Vice Chancellor Conten. Welcome to the committee, Vice Chancellor.
Thank you, Chair Rukavina.
And I just love your Morris campus, too.
Oh, thank you. Thank you. It is a little jewel out in the prairie, as we describe it. Chair Rukavina, the members of the committee, it's my pleasure to substitute today for Chancellor Johnson, who is actually participating in a national meeting to discuss some of the efforts that we have on our campus on renewable energy. So she is unable to be in two places at once. She can do a lot, but she hasn't figured out how to be in two places at once. So I'm substituting for her. I'd like to begin just simply and quickly by echoing what President Brunick so carefully and skillfully said is the importance of the universities as economic drivers. The University of Minnesota Morris is an economic driver in west central part of the state. The community and the region are dependent upon us, not only to educate the young people from there as well as from across the world, but also to prepare for a new economy and for new jobs in the region. As many of you know, we are innovative and leading both the university and the state in renewable energy projects, and we are partnering with the Minsky system and other public and private entities to ensure that the region is prepared to prosper and grow. We're using the infrastructure and resources we have, the campus, biomass, and wind, as a training ground and research laboratory for technical college students as well as for our baccalaureate students. I'd like to give you just a quick update on some of the progress on the initiatives in our on our campus and then tell you a little bit about how we're trying to respond to some of the budget challenges that we have. Our graduation rates and retention rates are showing continued improvement and have been highest in the university system. We have a demonstrated record of partnering with our neighbors. And I'll just mention our regional fitness center, which we partner with the region, the counties, and cities in the area for our own fitness center on campus, as well as shared with the counties and city. And we share our football field, not Division One or Two, but now Division Three. We share our football field with the high school. So we know how intertwined we are with our community and how we need to conserve our resources as scarce as they are. We are one of a handful of institutions in the country that provide free tuition to American Indian students. Part of our legacy is an agreement that was struck in the early 1900s between the federal government when turned over lands and buildings to the state of Minnesota, and we have kept that commitment for over 100 years. 11% of our students are American Indian. This is one of the highest percentages in the nation outside of tribal schools. We are working to strengthen our partnerships with these tribal schools to ensure that we're serving even more students. But that free tuition, the cost of that free tuition, is borne by the University of Minnesota and the University of Minnesota Morris. It's a significant part of our budget, and we won't compromise it. But cuts will mean we'll have to go deeper in other areas. Let me tell you a little bit about how we are starting to cope with some of the challenges that we have. I feel a little uncomfortable in this nice cushy chair. The folding one actually fit our style better. Just so that you have a sense of what it's like to be on a small campus, cuts are felt in a big way. Just to give you a sense of our small campus environment, we all take our garbage out, including the chancellor. We empty our garbage cans. I'm tempted to do it right here in front of me. Empty the garbage can and take it out to the bin behind the building, but that's something that we do because we have to. We're a small campus, and we don't have the sorts of resources to support that. We have 10 to 12 open faculty positions. We have suspended 3 searches already this year, and our continuing faculty searches will be in areas that are essential. And let me underline the word essential, to continuing the integrity of our academic offerings. We're rethinking and restructuring staff positions that will become vacant through retirements. We've cut travel, and we're extending the life of our computers and other equipment. We've canceled and delayed projects for renovation and refurbishing. In fact, one of our facilities in most need of refurbishing is our recital hall, which is used by not only our students, faculty, and staff, but is also used by members of the community because we are one of the performing arts venues in the west central part of the state. That hall is in desperate need of new furniture. However, we won't be able to do that this year because part of the cuts that we've already received this fiscal year, we have had to sacrifice that project. And with well over 70% of our budget tied up in salaries, this will inevitably mean some personnel cuts. And we're on a shoestring already, it's tough. And as I'm sure many of you do know, salaries aren't necessarily the best in our system, and it's going to become an even bigger challenge for us to retain and attract new faculty and staff to our campus if we continue to go through the sorts of potential cuts that we're looking at. So, Mr. Chairman, thank you very much. Members of the committee.
Thank you very much, and I'm delighted to hear about, and I'd like to talk to you a little more about your bringing in technical students from your technical schools off there. I've been on your campus. You were just starting the biomass or biofuel project when I was there. Let's have, how about Chancellor Casey next?
Thank you, Chairman Ravina, members of the committee. Appreciate the opportunity to make some brief comments this afternoon. I want to emphasize one thing. At the Kirkston campus, the president has been very upfront and clear to me that we have to leverage all the resources that the university has in the Kirkston community. We have the campus with 1,200 and some students, but we have a research and outreach center. We have a regional extension center. We have a Northwest Regional Sustainable Development Partnership. And most recently, we have an area health education center. So there's a lot of University of Minnesota resources beyond just the campus that I'm responsible for. We take that very seriously in serving the land-grant mission of the university in education, research, and outreach. So I want to emphasize that that's a high priority for me and my colleagues in the Crookston community. Others have talked about the loss of momentum, and I certainly feel that the lost opportunities that we won't be able to have. We have the highest enrollment we've ever had on the Crookston campus because our faculty and staff have worked hard to recruit students from the region. We've increased our international students. We've increased our students of color. And we've increased our online students. So they've really worked hard over the past few years. We've used some of those resources to hire new faculty. Faculty that are going to ensure the quality of our programs and ultimately the quality of our graduates. So that's what I worry about in terms of the possibility of losing some momentum. We have a very high percentage of our students, about 55% of our students, are first-generation college students. That means we have to provide a lot of resources, more advisors. We have smaller class size. We work hard to increase our retention rate, our graduation rate, which is something that all of you want us to do. I worry about whether we have to make some of those reductions in those student service areas that will impact the ability to make those students successful into the future. I won't go through all of the same things that my colleagues have talked about in terms of reductions. I think all of us are looking at some of the same things. We look at the majors we're offering. Are we offering the right majors? Can we, instead of offering classes once a year or every semester, do we do it every other year? But some of those strategies are going to delay the graduation of students, and that's not where we want to head either. So support what the president's talked about, what my colleagues have talked about, and say that we recognize that we have to be part of it, and we'll do that. We'll do that. But we also must face our long-term responsibility to serve the region. I believe that education is the best investment to improve the quality of life of an individual, the family, and their community. And I trust we'll be able to continue to provide that opportunity to the individuals in our part of the state well into the future. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Chancellor. And finally, last but not least, our newest chancellor, I guess I would say, at least newest school campus, Chancellor Lenkel. Welcome.
I've been here about a year and a half. We are beginning a new university. At the president's encouragement, we wanted to capitalize on the opportunity that we are new and that we could explore developing a new model for higher education, mindful of the fact that our revenue sources are changing and that our students are changing and the definition of learning is changing. He's also encouraged me to really push the envelope of partnerships and see how far we can use that in terms of developing our new model for higher education. So over the past year, just to give you an update, we currently serve about 400 students at the University of Minnesota Rochester. All those students are served by programs that are done in partnership with my colleagues sitting here at the table. For example, Chancellor Martin's campus is delivering a Bachelor of Fine Arts program in Rochester in graphic design. She's also delivering, her business school is delivering a Master's in Business Administration. And that's done in combination of using interactive TV, the internet, or weekend courses where faculty will drive down from Duluth on Friday night and work with students on Friday and all day Saturday every other week. We offer now about 30 academic programs that are done in partnership. We have a program in nursing. We have programs in computer science, computer engineering, education, social work, public health. In fact, we just launched a new program this past year in partnership in Masters of Biostatistics. It turns out that Mayo Clinic has 300 biostatisticians, and they were getting a correspondence course from Iowa State. The School of Public Health is rated one of the third in the nation. I thought it was a good idea that we just connected University of Minnesota with Mayo Clinic. So we currently have 400 students. We are building two new programs. The graduate program that we are building is again based on a partnership. It's biomedical informatics and computational biology. Best way to think about this is just getting people together, researchers together from different disciplines that are geographically distributed and having work on common problems. This is a partnership between Mayo Clinic, IBM, the Hormel Institute, and University of Minnesota. University of Minnesota Rochester, quite frankly, is serving as sort of the matchmaker in the administrative arm of this program. Just to give an example, 2 years ago we had a symposium and 30 researchers showed up. We just had one last Friday, 130 showed up. We have researchers that are submitting grants together, getting funding. We have 42 members who are serving on the faculty. We have not paid any additional salaries. We have 8 students in a master's and PhD program. So again, it's a partnership-based program, I think really creating some exciting opportunities for students. The third program is one undergraduate program that we are going to deliver. It's a Bachelor of Science of Health Sciences. It's unique in its structure in the sense that we are asking students not up front whether they want to be a doctor, a pharmacist, or a dentist, or an echocardiologist, or a health researcher, or a health journalist or whatever. We're asking them up front, do you have an interest in the health field? We will put everybody through a common curriculum, consider that sort of as the trunk of our tree, and then in their later part of their curriculum, the third and fourth years, we will create sort of different opportunities for students to pursue a variety of health careers. So for instance, if they're interested in pursuing dentistry or optometry or pharmacy, we will serve as a conduit for them to get into those professional programs. On the other hand, if they would like to have a degree in respiratory care, echocardiology, there's 20 of those sort of certificate programs at Mayo Clinic. They can do that as part of what we call the path of experience. On the other hand, we will help them to get an early start in a master's program. So if they would like to pursue a program that is offered at the University of Minnesota in health journalism, or exercise science, or kinesiology. They can get started in that in their senior year, and hopefully it's be completed in 5 years rather than 4. We're recruiting students for that program currently. We hope to admit 150 freshmen in the fall. In terms of the budget cuts, we're doing our best. It's certainly going to slip. We're in the process of hiring faculty and preparing for our freshman class. Clearly, those cuts are going to slow down that rate of hiring, that rate of growth. Certainly, my challenge is to make sure that although it will slow us down, it doesn't stunt our overall growth.
Thank you very much. President Bronick, you want to come back down? I know that Representative Reiner had a question for you, and if you folks want to stay there, that's fine. There may be questions for the campus chancellors too, but Mr. Fitzenreiter, I suppose you want to come down too. Representative Reiner.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm sorry to...
By the way, I was just going to tell you, Vice Chancellor, that President Brunig empties his wastebasket when Fitzenreiter shreds all those papers that I've been asking for, and he finds out they're coming here. But then he empties it. I did ask for some information, I believe, on technology. Did you get that question from my office? I honestly know on technology. We'll talk about it afterwards. Yeah. But go ahead, Representative Brunig.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. President Brunix, I realize that many of your last comments may have been an indirect response to this, but I'd like to hear directly your response to the governor's recommendation for a tuition cap.
Chair Rukavina, Representative Reiner, I think it'd be devastating. I think it fits all the definitions that Mencken was talking about. It's a simple, neat and wrong approach to the future. I'm hoping he won't recommend that. We all know, everybody that I know in my position gets up every day worrying about this issue, and we work hard to reduce costs and to try to drive expenditures down to their lowest possible level at the university. And I'm not going to take, I'll be honest with you, I'll put this on the record today, I'm not going to take a high tuition proposal forward to the university's Board of Regents, anything in the neighborhood that we had in the last severe budget downturn. This is a completely different environment. Families are under enormous stress. The liquidity in their homes and their second mortgages is just simply not there. It's harder to borrow today than it was back in 2002. So I think I've been saying to our students, and I have some of the best conversations I've ever had about tuition and tuition policy I've had with students, and I've had them not just in the past, but very much this year. So our first approach will be to reduce costs and to drive out the costs wherever we can find them, to eliminate some longer-term investments and shorter-term investments, to suspend some, to reduce some. Obviously, as Vice President Fitzenreiter said, there are some things you just simply have to pay for, no matter what the state's budget environment might look like. And then, of course, we'll look at revenue sources, but tuition increases will be the last thing on the list, and it'll be part of the final solution. But a freeze on tuition would be absolutely devastating. I would argue it is the most non-competitive approach you can make to a free market issue that I can think of. I find it kind of curious that we get this kind of a recommendation in this sort of environment. What happens when you get you put freezes on, you know, and wage and price controls and things of that sort, you develop all kinds of perverse behaviors in the system and you drive out creativity. We've had more creative activity about how to keep higher education affordable in this higher tuition environment than the university has had in the last 50 years. It forces your attention on the issues, and it really makes you work together to come up with really creative solutions. We've raised more than $250 million by going out and just pounding on doors in the last 5 years and arguing with people that it's very important to support young people today. And we wouldn't have done that if we hadn't had the flexibility to solve our own problems. And so I really want to hit that one really hard. But I got to tell you, anyone in higher education that thinks they're going to solve this budget problem with high tuition rates is whistling in the wind. I just think it shouldn't. I don't think it's responsible, and it's not a position that I would take at this time. But I think it has to be a part of the ultimate solution. Representative Rukavina, if I could just ask your indulgence, we had a little misstep in giving you some facts a few moments ago, and I'd like to give Vice President Fitzenreiter a chance to quickly correct it.
I don't know if it's taking the oath of office again, but I did flop.
Raise your right hand.
Continue, Justice Roberts.
On the biennial budget reduction in May of 2008, The UMail partnership was reduced $3 million on that pie chart. It represents 24% of the solution. Sent reserves was $3.1 million, 25%, and investment delays were $6.2 million, or the 51%. I had it wrong.
The chart was right, and the vice chancellor was wrong.
Correct, Mr. Chair.
The computer program worked. Questions? More questions for Representative Mahoney.
I know we've only got about a minute, Mr. Chair. I've got two questions, and you can provide to me later. You know, you talk about 14,000 graduates per year. Could you break that down by your campuses for me? I'd appreciate that. You can send that over. My other question is, the 25 years or 50 years ago, what was the percentage of the state budget, the percentage of your budget coming from the state? And if you get what is it today? And I don't know what the cut will be, but I guess we can do that math after that.
Chair Rukavina, Representative Mahoney, I believe 25 years ago, and Dr. Oh, it's right here. See, there's not a question you can ask that we don't have a sheet on, it looks like.
I'd be careful how I phrase that one.
Yeah, I better, yeah. this isn't the one, though, is it? Anyway, I think this is the degree sheet that you asked about. I think it was pretty close to 72%. It was in the high 70s. It's now pretty close to 25%. But you need to remember that a good deal of our state support comes in the form of dedicated special appropriations to run the Extension Service, the Research and Outreach Centers. So if you think about the percentage of funding that comes from the state that goes into instruction and just sort of core academic support, that's closer to about 21-22%.
Just a quick follow-up, Mr. Chair.
Before you do, Representative Mahoney, you're going to move the minutes to Tuesday's meeting. Are there any
corrections?
Or corrections?
They are perfect.
Not all those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Okay, go ahead.
At what point does the state become irrelevant to you?
Chair Rukavina,
I want
Representative Mahoney, I can tell you... right now, the state funding is about $702 million and tuition is about $625. If you model some of the budget scenarios that we've been talking about here today, and we've obviously been working on mostly federal and other sources of funding for research, and tuition dollars will greatly exceed, each of them greatly exceed state support for the first time in the university's entire nearly 160-year history. So that's one answer. I find that to be sobering. I find it to be deeply disturbing. And I think it will ultimately compromise the long-term future of the university. So I hope those trend lines do not hold on a permanent basis, but I'm deeply worried about it. And direct answer to your question, there is no time that I can foresee in my lifetime where state support for the University of Minnesota will be irrelevant. I really think this partnership with the state over a 160-year period has developed an absolutely phenomenal University of Minnesota system. It is probably the most important comparative advantage we have in the world economy, not just our institutions of higher education, but I think what we have in higher education and the higher education landscape of Minnesota. So I hope that it will never be irrelevant. I hope the state is our constant partner, that we work through these issues together and come out the other side of this economic difficulty with a real long-term commitment to human capital and innovation. Without, I think, Minnesota could be a backwater state in the global economy.
Well, Mr. President and Chancellor, thank you very much for coming today. I'm glad you mentioned our partnership, because I think we're going to have a good, close working relationship when we look at these cuts. And, you know, I don't want to... You mentioned early on, President Bronick, about let us have some leeway, and we have let
you know, both the Minsky and the university system have leeway, but, you know, I certainly want us to have, this committee to have some input, because that's our job.
Mm-hmm.
And sometimes we don't always agree on, you know, what the blend should be in tuition increases, perhaps, versus where other dollars are going to have to be cut and where other dollars are going to be raised. I have to commend you for what you have done as far as getting money to particularly Minnesota students who you have tried to help with the tuition. And you've done a good job raising money for different scholarships at the university. But, you know, that hasn't, a lot of that has not been geared towards that student in an upper graduate class either. And so I noticed that some of those spikes last year were a little higher than I would have liked to see them. So, you know, we're going to be working together.
We will.
But I like
it. I look forward to it. I truly do. You.
I just want the members to know. I want all of us to be very active in looking at all of the budgets that this committee oversees, because this is going to be a very, very difficult year for us. And I've said it before, and I'm going to say it again. And I think the president and almost everyone in this room will agree with me. We cannot get out of this place this year just by making cuts to the state budget. There's going to have to be some revenue sources. And I think it's all of our jobs to work and convince some people that aren't in this room that that's got to be the case. So I'm willing to work certainly with all of you, and I'm glad that you came by today again, and we'll see you, I'm sure, more often this year than most years. So,
good.
With that, members, we'll see you on
you.
Monday, I believe, meeting adjourned.